uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. It's Moonbat edition here, Tuesday now going into Wednesday, 3rd into the 4th of May 2011. Glad you could join us here tonight. And, getting Moonbatty. It's Moonbatty as hail tonight. It's loud. It's late, and we're going to get loud and make some noise and be up late here and get Moonbatty. Ow! Werewolves of London. I mean, it makes you want to howl, right? It's fucking late as shit. Anyway, thanks so much for being with us here tonight. And we're going to be reading from William Bramley's Gods of Eden tonight. We didn't get to do that last night because we were talking about all this other stuff. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to talk about that other stuff less and do more reading from Bramley tonight. So not a lot of news stories. Not going to talk about some of the important stuff, some of the various things with the what's happening in the news, obviously. So, but I'm not going to go too far into it, but I do have an email I need to get into tonight. We'd love to have your emails as well. I just have one here tonight so far I need to get into, but, love to hear from you. If you have any emails you want to send in tonight, globalrealityshow@gmail.com. It's globalrealityshow@gmail.com. And I can answer your emails during the show while I'm live here on the broadcast. I can go there and I can, read them during the show. So if you have anything you want me to talk about and want to hear about from me tonight, globalrealityshow@gmail.com is where you can send those over to, and I'll do my best to answer your questions there. I was talking to some people in the chat room earlier, letting everybody know. I already know that I already have a reputation for being sporadic and flaky and whatever else when it comes to doing radio shows, just doing what I want to do them, but... it's probably going to continue to be that way for quite some time. My dad has had some bouts with cancer over the past several years and started out as small cell carcinoma lung cancer. He beat that, was cancer-free for a good time, then it moved into his lungs, and then he got some on his liver, and then treated that, and it went away, and then he got some on his brain, and then he treated that, and now it's come back on his spine, and I think into his brain, and he had to go to the hospital last night. Because he didn't know how much medication he took. And, they've got him on all those. It's just, it's sad. It makes you sad, man, to see. Some people understand and get what this medical industrial complex stuff's all about, and other people don't. It makes it very difficult to, to not just want to yell and scream and at everybody you see about what this is. They're doing my dad like they've done everybody else, man. They know he's got a good insurance policy, so they're, keeping him alive long enough to get every penny out of his insurance policy. And it's very difficult to make people understand that. But that's exactly what's going on here. And, I don't know how much time he's got left. I don't know. I think also some people think that, because I'm not crying and bawling and all this shit, that I'm somehow not affected emotionally by it or something. It's just not, that's just a different It's a different thing. My thing is that I'm pissed off about this because none of this ever has to happen. I mean, they literally have the audacity to tell my stepmother that a couple of years ago that the stuff that Jamie was doing to offset the chemo, like chemo cleanse, some of these herbal remedies, was actually killing him and making it worse. Because we were trying to get him to do some things to offset this with herbal stuff, from the chemo and all this crap that he's had, radiation, and I don't know how many times they've given him that stuff. So it's a very difficult thing for me because I know all the causes of this. I know what this is. These magicians that run the medical industry are designed to suck you dry and never make you better and keep you alive and keep you this and keep you in pain and keep you in medication. I mean, it's no way to live. Having to be on medication every day and all this stuff just to prolong your life for this to happen again for you have to go through it. For me personally, and I don't know how it is for my dad, I don't really know how he totally feels about this, but I don't know, man. For me, that's just no way to live. That would be no way to live. It's just like continuing to go through this and, I don't know, but my point is that, if he doesn't make it any sometime soon, it's going to affect, the show for a while. We're not going to have any shows for a while. While that's, if that happens or anything, just letting you know ahead of time. I'm going to be indisposed, not going to be able to make work on the film, not going to be able to do anything probably for a couple of weeks. I'll probably need some financial support too. Cause I don't have a suit or any of that stuff to wear to a funeral, man. I hope this doesn't play out the way I think it's going to, but at this point I think it is. I don't know. I think that keeping someone in misery and pain just so you can get more money out of them while simultaneously, because these doctors don't tell you shit, they're not really saying anything. They're not really giving any sort of information. And I've already seen them do this. My grandfather died of cancer in 2004 on my dad's side, my dad's father, then my dad got it just a few years later. And my grandmother, my mom's side, it was like my mother and raised me pretty much my whole life. They did the same thing to her last year. Back last year, last February, 2010. They get her in there and, tell her this, that they can't do anything about her cancer that's in her intestines and stuff. And so, they just medicate her until she quietly until the cancer quietly consumed her. And I heard, conflicting weird stories about the whole thing from my mother. My mother told me one story that was conflicting and weird. My aunt told me another story that was conflicting and weird. I don't know. The one thing you have to remember is that this is the illusion. The misery, the pain, the suffering, this is the illusion. And that's why the manipulators of this illusion can be found at the highest levels of everything you can name, from the medical industry to government to big corporations to media. It doesn't matter. And we have to understand that all of this is an illusion. It's limited. It's transitory. And we can't let our emotions override what we know to be true. I refuse to let my emotions override what I know to be true. And when you, because if you don't, then you're going to be, when your emotions are running your head and not what you know to be true, you're just, you know, you're just sort of, you're going hog wild. It's like, you know, what I talked about a while ago about, you know, I got the documents mode. I got the documents, son. I got the documents. Ah, you know, you're going fucking ape shit, going ballistic crazy. You know, it's kind of like that. But you know, because when you're running on just sheer emotion, you're not thinking logically. You know what I mean? You're just, you're running around all over the place. And that's what these fear merchants and these people like Alex Jones and others, this is what their job is. Their job is to, you know, keep you in a state of panic where you're operating on an emotional level where, you know, you can't think straight. My mission is as it always is. And it's funny. There's just, you know, it's hard for me to really relate to a lot of people in my family because a lot of people in my family, they don't know. They don't get it. They don't know what I do. They don't understand what it's about. And, you know, and I'm sure if my dad passes away, there, you know, there's going to be a whole bunch of family standing around. Everybody's going to be blubbering and crying. And all this shit. And I'm going to be standing there, you know, stoic with a straight, with just a straight face, look on my face. You're probably going to be asking why I'm not blubbering and crying. And it's going to be very hard for me to say because I'm not emotionally upset about the situation with my father passing away. I am emotionally upset about the fact that the answers to why this is happening and everybody's family members all over the planet are dying from cancer and HIV and whatever else is because of these people who are in charge. And we have the information, we have the knowledge now, but we're still too enamored and too in love with television and media and distractions and football games. So, you know, call me an asshole. Call me what you will. I got to be 100% honest. It is very difficult for me to go to a funeral for somebody who died from cancer or something else. I don't care how old they were, and get emotionally upset about it. I'm pissed off. We should be fighting this. My God, they're doing this to us, and we're allowing it. I don't have time to sit around and cry about it. I've got to take every fucking moment I have left to do something about it. And if I'm sitting around crying about something, I feel like I'm wasting the time and energy I could be putting back into this, try to do something about stopping it. That's what I'm here for. That's what I've been put here to do. And I feel lucky every day that I was lucky enough to find what my calling in life is, and it's this. Trying to do something small and insignificant as it may seem in the grander scheme of things to everybody in the world does not matter. It's what I have to do. It's not what everybody else has to do, but it's what I have to do. So if I don't seem like an emotional wreck about things sometimes when I should be, it's because I am using that energy and channeling that back to where it needs to be for me, and that is back towards something constructive and positive. Better get used to seeing the ones you love die if you're not already. I went through this stuff a lot. I started going through this at an early age, actually, because I had a friend in high school named Brandon that got killed in a car wreck. So at, you know, 15, 16 years old, I was already having to learn these lessons, and it's just continued on and on throughout my life, periodically, you know. But I've progressed so much as a person, and my intellect and my mentality and my worldview and everything has progressed so much through the years that, you know, crying over someone's death, you know, crying over someone being set free from this material spiritual bondage, I just can't do it. I can't be sad for somebody. I mean, yeah. It sucks down here. Yeah, it's pretty much purgatory down here. But that doesn't mean that you don't still try to do something about it with the time you have while you're here. And that's what I'm going to continue to do. People need to be aware of the medical industrial complex. They need to be aware how these bankers came in and set up this medical industry. It is a fact. It's not a conspiracy theory. The bankers set up the medical industrial complex for their gain, and in some cases actually had chapters of their banks inside of the buildings that the pharmaceutical companies were located in, and that is a fact. Chase Manhattan Bank had offices inside of the pharmaceutical companies, probably still do, that they owned and control. This is about creating illnesses. They create diseases. They pump the food and the water and everything and all the processed foods, everything processed. They pump all this through it, cigarettes, alcohol. The medication itself, they tell you, is to cure you or to make you better. In many cases, is bad for you. It's on your liver and everything else and your bloodstream. Oh, my God. So they pump all this stuff in there, and then they cause this to happen. And then when we get sick, what do? Well, we go running to them, don't we? We go running to daddy. What do? When we get hungry, we go running to the person that controls the food and has the food locked behind a door. They won't give it to us unless we give them money. What do? When we're sick, we go to the shaman, who's now the local doctor, who is a pimp and a pusher and a drug dealer, no different than some crackhead who slings crack to little 8-year-olds. Yeah, your local family doctor now is a goddamn pusher, and that's a fact. They are an officially licensed and sanctioned pusher of pharmaceutical drugs on the world. In many cases, these drugs are more harmful for you than the ones that they claim to be illegal. I got OxyContin and all that shit. And oh my God, man. All those SSRIs. Marijuana's illegal. Mushrooms are illegal. Plants that grow naturally that we can use to heal ourselves are illegal. Our chemicals that we make artificially are not. So they're doing all this, and then again, you know, when we get sick, we go running to them as if that's the only... We have to educate people. That if you get sick and you go running to them, to the medical establishment, you are not going to get better. They are designed to kill you. Now, I know on the lower level, there are some things in some of their technology and advancements that are good and we do need, and I'll give you that. No problem. Yeah, I'm all for that. But that's not what I'm talking about here, guys. Everything that we've ever needed to cure, anything that may go wrong naturally with the human body, has been provided for us here on the planet. But since we have turned this planet into one big, gigantic, goddamn swap meet free-for-all, with a bunch of little faggoty kids running around. Oh, this is mine over here. Oh, this is mine over here. Oh, this land over here is mine. Beep, 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 beep. Killing each other and launching missiles and all this shit. Bunch of limp wrist little cocksuckers they are that run this planet. I'm not afraid to say it. Everything is designed to perpetuate itself. Everything within this system is designed to perpetuate itself. But where does it end and when does it end? Why do we allow it to continue when we see it going on? Am I supposed to just sit by until every single family member that I have croaks from cancer before I stand up and say, you know what, I'm not going to shed a tear over this? And you shouldn't either. You should get up off your fucking lazy ass. You should look at the facts of how these people create these illnesses, put them out there, and then charge us to extend our lives long enough until they can bleed us dry and milk all our money out of the bank and kill us and then do it again to the next person. My mom had got breast cancer a couple years ago and beat it. Here, my aunt, my mom's sister, has cancer now. It was ridiculous. On both sides of my family, guys. So, you know, I mean, your average person, I guess, if this happened to them, what would your average person do in this situation? If they didn't know about this, what, you know, my family's died of cancer, you know. What good does that do? You're still a fucking victim. Why do we want to be the victim so much? Why can't we be the victor? Haven't we been the victim long enough? Everybody in your family died of cancer, you can sit around and cry about it. No, I'm going to do something about it. Or I'm going to try to. I'm going to die fucking trying. One or the other. Whatever comes first. I'm not going to stop. Ever. They're going to dig a hole and put me in the ground next to my old man before I stop doing this. Got me? That's real. All right, let's get into, got an email here tonight, and this came from Scott Monochromo, who's a great supporter of ours and has challenged me to have the C-Ride Volume 2 out by no later than 7/1/2011, and come hell or high water, that's what I'm going to do, no matter what happens, okay? So Scott has a great question here tonight, and this is a super question. thanks Scott for this question. I mean, this is a super question. This is a very, very, I mean, very important question. And I apologize for not covering this last night in my coverage of the Bin Laden fiasco, because I was thinking about it and I had already gone through it. So it says, "Hi Josh, I know this question about horseshit politics, but this baffles me and I haven't heard anyone talk about it. The 2012 election isn't for another 18 months. Why do you think Obama and or his controllers would use up all this political capital now by killing Bin Laden right now? They could have done this a lot closer to the election. This issue could easily die off quickly." Great question, Scott. And, first off, the fact that the 2012 election is another 18 months away is irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. I mean, back when I first started on radio in September of 2007, even before it had been going for probably about, since about March of 2007, March, April, 2007, something in there, Ron Paul mania was already in full swing. I started on my radio show in September 2007. It had been in full swing for 3 or 4 months. Because a few months before I'd even started my radio show, we'd went to this straw poll thing in Fort Worth where Ron Paul was there and Jimmy Vaughn was there. It was cool. I mean, you're talking about, you know, August, September 2008, 2007, something like that. You'd have the elections on November. So, I mean, you know, they start this stuff really early, Scott. I mean, they really start setting up the table for what the flavor and the tone and everything is going to be for the elections way in advance. And so that's answer number one about the elections. Why do you think that his and his controllers would use up all their political capital by killing Bin Laden right now? Well, number one, look at everything else that's been going on. Gas prices, the Japan stuff, all the war. They needed, right now, they needed a game-changing thing to happen because, to change the eyes of the people, because the people have seen really nothing change under Obama, even the people that voted for it. And there has already been impeachment stuff that's been talked about Obama, all the negative stuff from the birth certificate. the fact that he's gone golfing more times than Bush did under his, I mean, it just on and on and on and on and on. But so I think was perfect timing for them to launch this right now. But I think that also Scott is, I think there's going to be so many other goddamn crazy things that are going to happen between now and then that, yeah, you're right. You know, this issue could die off quickly. I think that the stuff that's going to happen probably the rest of this year from here on out is going to make this story, the Bin Laden thing, seem like, you know, any other PAP story that came out into the rest of the year will go, oh, yeah, the Bin Laden thing happened this year too. Huh? I forgot about that with all this other crazy madness that's been going on. So I think that there are other levels also of the whole Bin Laden caper. I mean, we've got some stories here tonight that we'll talk about that I think add some weight to that. I think it's because they haven't, this op hasn't stopped yet. This whole op concerning the capturing and killing of Bin Laden has not run its course yet. It's not near over. And if you've been looking at paying attention to the news over the past couple of days, you'll get the very, very sneaky impression that is indeed what's happening. It's not over by a damn sight. They're not done with this yet. They're not running this finished running this operation yet. It seems to me that they're already putting a lot of, I mean, there's already people doubting it. Some people saying that, you know, the U.S. might have staged this, which is just such a weird conspiracy. You know, people starting these phony conspiracy theories, you know, the U.S. staged it. And then that gets lumped in with people. Oh, yeah, well, those same people say they staged 9/11. You see, this is, to me, I don't see any disconnect between the 9/11 operation and the Osama bin Laden operation. Personally, for me, I see this as the next level of it. This is a continuation of it. Because just like the steel from the World Trade Center, just like the gold in the World Trade Center, you know, we were never allowed to see any evidence of his body or anything else of that nature. Now they're saying they're going to release some phony video. So to answer your question, Scott, I think the reason that they're bringing this out now is because there are things that haven't happened yet. They're going to be happening the rest of this year. They're going to continue this operation that they're going to have to do. But in order for them to be able to do it, they've got to have Bin Laden dead. And not only that, I think it was also, if you hear stories of people who are going over there, I mean, they're running out of shit to shoot. That's why they've been stirring up stuff in they've been stirring up more stuff in Egypt and Yemen and all the rest of these places, and they're just flat running out of stuff to shoot. So they start, you know, now, like I said last night, I think also this gives them the ability to be able to launch any sort of false flag operations they want to run now, because they'll just be able to say, oh, well, yeah, you know, this was terrorists and they did it because we killed Osama bin Laden. They'll be able to milk that for a long time. I think that the reason they rolled this out now is because it's a win-win either way. They're not going to allow this to die off in terms of how they're going to use it in their political campaign. That's what it is. It's huge political leverage when it comes to the campaign season. Doesn't matter if it happened 18 months before the elections. The whole election cycle is going to be, you know, or all the election stop is going to be signs and T-shirts that say, Osama caught Obama. I predicted that like 2 years ago, literally on the show. If anybody out there that goes to the archives can find that show and cut that out and put that up, that'd be great. Because lo and behold, I saw a news article here tonight that it indeed has happened. The prophecy has been fulfilled, just as I predicted a couple of years ago. Company sells Obama got Osama T-shirts. A Florida company is offering a T-shirt celebrating the death of Osama bin Laden, which depicts the terrorist in crosshairs of a telescopic gun sight above the words, Obama got Osama, just as I predicted 2 years ago. And I said they'd do it right before the elections. This article from Yahoo Finance, I'm not going to read it, but it's entitled, How Bin Laden Failed to Wreck the U.S. Economy. How bin Laden, Bin Laden didn't, he tried to wreck the U.S. economy, but he didn't. I'm going, really? Well, maybe he didn't particularly, but the events of 9/11 and what they've done ever since then has. So if you believe what they tell you and Al-Qaeda and bin Laden was responsible for 9/11, then I would say, yeah, he did wreck the U.S. economy. This is just complete bullshit. If you get bored and you got something you want to read and you need to laugh, read this fucking article. I mean, it's just, it's all over the place. Man, oh man. White House changes Osama bin Laden account. Yeah, they're already switching their story around. You guys hear this? I mean, my God. You see how they're doing this? You see how they're making this very sloppy, how they're doing this in broad day? I mean, my God, they're, you know, oh, they've already changed their story. You think that these guys wouldn't have a bulletproof story if they wanted one? They're putting on a show now. You see this? See what they're doing, guys? I think that they're going to stage this whole fiasco. I remember how you all, not all of you listening, but, you know, remember how you haters out there were hating on me? Back in 2008, 2009, when I came on air and said the 9/11 Truth Movement was designed to bring down the United States of America, it was designed to pin all the blame for 9/11 onto the United States government and Condi and Bush and all these characters, so that the connection to the deeper power structure, the custodians, the priest class, Rome, the Zionists, British intelligence, Mossad, all of these things, none of these things would ever get connected to 9/11. They would simply blame it on the United States government, and they would use that to bring down the U.S. government so they can bring us into one step closer to global government and absorb us into globalist power structure. Well, that's exactly what I believe now they're going to do with this bin Laden case. I think they're going to, I think it's all going to come out. I think they're going to stage this whole charade involving the U.S. faking the death of bin Laden, and they're going to do this whole thing in the media, and oh my God, they lied to the world, and they didn't really capture him, oh my God, blah, 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 blah. And then the world's going to be calling for the U.S.'s head on a silver platter. I think this is it. I think to really answer your question finally there, Scott, I think that this is why they're rolling this out now. I think they're going to stage this whole fiasco in the media and really bring, you know, make a whole big fiasco about the United States faking his death and not have, because they're already saying now that maybe some of the DNA evidence and all this, some of the evidence is shiesty. Why would they be allowing this to come out now already? I mean, they're already setting the table for conspiratorial mindsets to just come in and just grab it and go all over it. You see, why would they be already offering up, oh, well, the blood sample and the DNA test may not be right. No, you know, we need to see pictures. And, oh, you know, they're hinting at it very, very slyly that the U.S. may have, you know, may need to show proof. Because all these stories keep coming up, you know, more and more that, oh, we need proof. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney on Tuesday publicly revised the administration's account of the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, telling reporters that the al-Qaeda leader wasn't armed during the assault, and didn't use one of his wives as a shield. Why would they report that and then go back later and say, oh, no, that isn't how it happened at all? If they allegedly had it on video, and if allegedly that Barack Obama was watching the video as it was happening. Of course, Bush said that he watched the first plane fly into the tower on 9/11, too. We know that was a lie, because none of that got shown live on television. None of it was, somebody filmed it. The Naudé brothers filmed it, but it wasn't going out live to television when they filmed it. So I just don't know how they can have a conflicting story here. If Barack Obama watched it happen on, you know, in real time on closed circuit TV, then you would think if there were discrepancies in the story, like they're saying here in this article, that Barack Obama would come out and say, let me set the record straight right here 1 minute. My goodness. I saw it. I watched it on video. It was great. I watched his brain splatter. It was rad. But I mean, really, I mean, I don't understand that. If the story, what they told us, is incorrect, how come Barack Obama can't confirm it if he watched it happen on video? We covered that story last night. They admitted that, allegedly, right? Something stinks here. On Monday evening, the White House had backed away from key details in a narrative about the raid, including claims by senior U.S. officials that bin Laden had a weapon and may have fired it during a gun battle with U.S. forces. Officials also retreated from claims that one of bin Laden's wives was killed in the raid. Carney read a statement to reporters Tuesday seeking to clarify discrepancies. He said bin Laden was not armed when a U.S. assaulter approached him. The Al-Qaeda leader's wife rushed the assaulter, and that woman was shot but not killed, Carney said. Oh, now they're saying, no, she wasn't killed. Oh, it was too gruesome, I guess, for the public to believe that his wife ran in front of him and was used as human shield and got shot to death. It's much more fluffy for the if the media believes that, well, she was shot, yes, but she wasn't killed. Again, why can't Obama confirm that motherfucker should be put on the stand? I mean, this is huge, guys. This is the kind of legal stuff that we need to be putting together and documenting so we can put these motherfuckers on trial one day, hopefully. I mean, if they reported last night in the news, if it's true what they reported that we covered on the show last night, that Barack Obama watched the raid in real time, he should be put on the stand to testify as to which one of these stories is true, because this is ridiculous. Obviously, some information came in piece by piece and is being reviewed and updated and elaborated upon. Carney told reporters that resistance does not require a firearm, but directed questions about how bin Laden resisted to the Pentagon. Carney's clarification came a day after when the administration's account had appeared to change but had not been publicly corrected. At a televised White House briefing Monday afternoon, Deputy National Security Advisor John Brennan had said bin Laden joined in the fight that several residents of Abbottabad, Pakistan compound put up against Navy SEALs during the 40-minute operation. So again, already changing the story. Changing what they originally came out with there. Unbelievable. It's now been confirmed. A record 226 tornadoes recorded over 24 hours last week. You know, I just more and more, I don't know how much of this stuff is, I really think there very well could be a weather war going on right now with this technology, but also I really think with, like we talked about last night, the planet being bombarded and these big great changes going on. It's insane. I mean, it's been, we've had the heater on here in Dallas. It's been in the 40s the past few days. In the 40s in Dallas in May? I don't think so. In fact, last time it was ever that cold in Dallas, it was 1908. So, yeah. I mean, we were running around in fucking shorts and tank tops, had the AC blasting fucking 3 or 4 days ago. Now we got jackets and fucking the heater on and shit. It's wild, man. Geronimo, a century after his death, mysteriously tied to bin Laden, the CIA, and Skull and Bones. This is from the Los Angeles Times. That's quite a heady article to be posted on the LA Times, don't you think? Geronimo was an Apache leader in the 19th century. More than 100 years after his death, the Native American warrior's name is back in the news when it was revealed that Geronimo was the code name used for Osama bin Laden while the U.S. Special Forces plotted to kill him. Born in what would later become New Mexico in 1829, Geronimo spent many years successfully fighting Mexican and U.S. armies until in 1886 when he and 35 warriors surrendered to General Nelson Miles near the Arizona-New Mexico border. Geronimo was sent to an army outpost at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, where he eventually died of pneumonia in 1909. In 1918, according to legend, members of the secret Skull and Bones Club at Yale, including allegedly former President George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, dug up Geronimo's grave when a group of army volunteers from Ivy League school was stationed at Fort Sill during World War I. The grave robbers took Geronimo's skull and some of his bones. On the 99th anniversary of Geronimo's death, a group of 20 of the warrior descendants sued the U.S. government's Skull and Bones and Yale in an attempt to rebury their ancestors' bones near his birthplace. In 2010, Judge Richard Roberts granted a Justice Department motion to dismiss the suit. Geronimo's relatives, he said, failed to establish that the government waived its right not to be sued. Roberts also dismissed the lawsuit against Skull and Bones and Yale, saying the plaintiff signed a law that applies only to Native American cultural items excavated or discovered after 1990. Though Skull and Bones is often known as a Yale organization, The college has never officially recognized it. When President George W. Bush was asked on Meet the Press about Skull and Bones, he said, "It's so secret we can't talk about it." Dan Oldenburg of the Washington Post wrote, "Conspiracy theorists have a field day over the fact that Bonesmen were among the founders of the Central Intelligence Agency. They love to point out the statues of the Patriot spy Nathan Hale, Yale, 1773, stand on both the university's campus and on the CIA's headquarters in Langley, Virginia." Though one of Oldenburg's sources has a perfectly good explanation for the coincidence, there's no doubt that more conspiracy theorists will reopen their argument that there is a relationship between Skull and Bones and the CIA. Now the world knows that the CIA-led mission to kill bin Laden used the name of an alleged victim of the secret society, Geronimo. Well, of course. You couldn't have said it better myself. Indeed, the situation we have there. So interesting article there out of the LA Times for sure. All right, well, we're going to take a break, come back. We're going to continue our reading. We stopped in the middle of a chapter last time. I can't remember the exact name of the chapter, but I've got the spot marked here out of William Bramley's The Gods of Eden. So we're going to take a break and come back, and after we get back from the break, we'll continue reading that. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. This is The Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. Be back in a few minutes.
Yours is the cloth, mine is the hand that sews time. His is the force that lies within. Ours is the fire, all warmth we can find. He is a feather in the wind. Earth, all of my love, all of my love to you now. All of my love, oh, yes, all of my love to you.
All right, back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thank you for being with us tonight for another Moonbat edition of the broadcast. Got to continue on reading with William Bramley's The God's Meeting here tonight. And my website is www.theglobalreality.com. It's where this broadcast originates from. And we started the show and the network and we started the show back in 2007 on the TruthNet radio network that Mike Chambers used to run and was on RBN. It was on WTPRN, Oracle, Blog Talk Radio, and then started my own network here. And I've been going ever since. And we don't get any outside funding and anything else. And this is what I do, and this is how I survive. So please donate if you can to the cause at the Chipman banner at the website for the bills and the operating costs of the month. And the donate button or anything else there, recurring subscriptions, donations. You can make a donation that comes out of your bank account every month. You can do that so you don't have to come back. But all that stuff there keeps us afloat and able to continue on with our work. So we don't have commercials here. We have 128K audio files and streams. So it's good, high quality stuff. And I think that's important. Somebody in the chat room today was bitching about the archives being 128K. I'm like, dude, it's high quality. You know, it's 2011. If you don't have, you know, hard drives are fucking cheap. Data storage is cheap. Bandwidth is cheap. I mean, you know, it just shouldn't be a problem. My thing is that, you know, Bill Cooper had a lot of good information, but when you hand somebody, this scratchy cassette recorded sounding recording, and, you know, with this bullhorn thing at the beginning of it, it's very difficult to get somebody to listen to that, you know. But when something sounds clear and it's easy to listen to, you're more likely to get the message across and get somebody to actually sit down and listen to something. So that's why I do that. And we do that because it's high quality and, you know, we don't have commercials on the rest of us. So support our work if you can. Please. We just paid the bill, so we're a little light for the for now. Let's continue on where we left off last week. The Boston Masonic Society peppered Governor Thomas Hutchison and the royal government from its meeting place in the Adjutant Trowell's Long Garret, where it is said more sedition, inciting to revolt, libels, and scurrility were hatched than in all the garrets in Grub Street. Otis and his Masonic brethren had become such adept muckrakers that Hutchison's friends believe that they must have ransacked Billingsgate and the stews for mud to sling at the Massachusetts aristocracy. We might wonder how American lodges became sources of revolt when they were nearly all chartered under the English system, which, as we recall, was pre-Hanoverian and forbade political controversy within the lodges. It must be kept in mind that by the 1760s, the anti-Hanoverian Templar degrees had become firmly established in Europe, and it also traveled secretly to many of the lodges in the American colonies. For example, as mentioned in an earlier chapter, St. Andrew's Lodge of Boston, which had perpetrated the Boston Tea Party in 1773, conferred a Templar degree already on August 28, 1769, after applying for the warrant in 1762 from the Scottish Grand Lodge in Edinburgh. That application was made almost a decade before the American Revolution began. Some Templars were not only anti-Hanoverian, they sought the abolition of all monarchy. The philosophical importance of Freemasonry to the American revolutionaries can also be seen in the symbols which the revolutionary leaders chose to represent the new American nation. They were Brotherhood Masonic symbols. Among a nation's most significant symbols is the national seal. An early proposal for the American National Seal was submitted by William Barton in 1782. In the upper right-hand corner of Barton's drawing is a pyramid with the tip missing. In place of the tip is a triangular all-seeing eye of God. The all-seeing eye, as we recall, has long been one of Freemasonry's most significant symbols. It was even sewn onto the Masonic aprons of George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and other Masonic revolutionaries. Above the pyramid and eye on Barton's proposal are the Latin words "Enuit Coeptis," which means he, God, hath prospered our beginning. On the bottom is the inscription, Novus Ordo Seclorum, the beginning of a new order of the ages. This bottom inscription tells us that the leaders of the revolution were pursuing a broad universal goal, which was encompassed with much more than their immediate concerns as colonists. They were envisioning a change in the entire world social order, which follows the goal announced in the Fama Fraternitas. Barton's pyramid and accompanying Latin inscriptions were adopted in their entirety. The design is still a part of the American Great Seal, which can be seen on the back of the U.S. $1 bill. The main portion of Barton's design was not adopted except for one small part. In the center of Barton's proposal is a shield with two human figures standing on either side. Perched atop the shield is a phoenix with wings outstretched. In the middle is a small phoenix burning in its funeral pyre. As discussed earlier, the phoenix is a brotherhood symbol used since the days of ancient Egypt. The phoenix was adopted by the founding fathers for use on the reverse of the first official seal of the United States after a design proposed by Charles Thompson, Secretary of the Continental Congress. The first die of the U.S. seal depicts a long-necked tufted bird, the phoenix. The phoenix holds in its mouth a banner with the words E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Above the bird's head are 13 stars breaking through a cloud. In one talon, the phoenix holds a cluster of arrows, in the other, an olive branch. Some people mistook the bird for a wild turkey because of the long neck. However, the phoenix is also long of neck, and all other features of the bird clearly indicate that it is a phoenix. The die was retired in 1841, and the phoenix was replaced by the bald eagle, America's national bird. Freemasons consider their fraternal ties to transcend their political and national divisions. When the war for American independence was over, however, the American lodges split from the Mother Lodge of London and created their own autonomous American Grand Lodge. The Scottish degree soon became dominant in American Freemasonry. The two major forms of Freemasonry practiced in the United States today are the York Rite, a version of the original English York Rite, and the Scottish Rite. The modern York Rite has a total of 10 degrees. The topmost is Knights Templar. The Scottish Rite has a total of 33 degrees, many of which are knight degrees. The influence of Freemasonry in American politics remained strong long after the Revolution was over. About one-third of all U.S. presidents have been Freemasons, most of them in the Scottish Rite. The influence of Freemasonry in American politics extended beyond the presidency. The U.S. Senate and House of Representatives have had a large Masonic membership for most of the nation's history. In 1924, for example, a Masonic publication listed 60 senators as Freemasons. They constituted over 60% of the Senate, more than 290 members of the House of Representatives were also named as lodge members. This Masonic presence has waned somewhat in recent years. Has it, or has it turned into something else? My research has shown me is that while the Masonic presence has waned, it hasn't waned. It's waned only in the United States, not in the UK, not in Britain. But what has increased has been Opus Dei members, Knights of Malta members. You're starting to see more and more of those in politics now, more than you see Freemasons now, specifically in the United States. Also in Canada, still huge for Freemasons up there as well. In an advertising supplement entitled Freemasonry, A Way of Life, the Grand Lodge of California revealed that in the 97th Congress, 1981 to 1983, there were only 28 lodge members in the Senate and 78 in the House. While that represents a substantial drop from the 1920s, Freemasonry still has a good-sized representation in the Senate, with more than a quarter of that legislative body populated by members of the craft. The American Revolution was more than a local uprising. It involved many nations. France was a secret participant in the American cause long before the actual outbreak of war. As early as 1767, the French foreign minister, Duke of Choiseul, had sent secret agents to the American colonies to gauge public opinion and to learn how far the seeds of revolt had grown. France also dispatched agent provocateurs to the colonies to secretly stir up anti-British sentiment. In 1767, Benjamin Franklin, who was not yet committed to armed warfare with England, accused France of attempting to blow up the coals between Britain and her American subjects. After Choiseul was deposed in 1770, his successor, Comte de Vergennes, continued Choiseul's policy and was instrumental in bringing about France's open military support for the American cause after the War of Independence began. Frederick the Great of Prussia was another to openly support the American rebels. He was among the first European rulers to recognize the United States as an independent nation. Frederick even went as far as closing his ports to Hessian mercenaries sailing to fight against the revolutionaries. Just how deeply Frederick was involved in the American cause may never be known, however. There is no doubt that many colonists felt indebted to him and viewed him as one of their moral and philosophical leaders. Decades after the Revolution, a number of Masonic lodges in America adopted several Scottish degrees which had reportedly been created by Frederick. The first American Lodge of the Scottish Rite, which was established in Charleston, South Carolina, published a circular on October 10, 1802, declaring that authorization of its highest degree came from Frederick, whom they still viewed as the head of all Freemasonry. Some scholars argue that Frederick was not active in Freemasonry in the late 1700s. They feel that his name was simply used to lend the right an air of authority. This argument may well be true, or at least partially so. The significance of the Charleston pamphlet lies in the loyalty that the early American Scottish Rite openly proclaimed to German Masonic sources so soon after the founding of the new American Republic. While some German Freemasons from Prussia were aiding the American cause, other German Masons were helping Great Britain at an enormous profit. Nearly 30,000 German soldiers were rented to Great Britain by six German states: Hesse Cassel, Hesse Hanau, Brunswick Haldeck, Anspach Bayreuth, and Anhalt Zerps. More than half of those troops were supplied by Hesse Cassel. Hence, all of the German soldiers were known as Hessians. The Hessian troops were considered to be the best of the mercenaries. Their accurate gunfire was feared by the colonial troops. In many battles, there were more Germans fighting for the British than there were British soldiers. In the Battle of Trenton, for example, Germans were the only soldiers against the Americans whom the Americans fought. This does not mean that the German soldiers were especially loyal to Britain or even to their own German rulers. Almost 1/6 of the German mercenaries, an estimated 5,000, deserted and stayed in America. The use of German mercenaries created a stir in both England and America. Many British leaders, including supporters of the monarch, objected to hiring foreign soldiers to subdue British subjects. For the Germans, the arrangement was as lucrative as ever. The Duke of Brunswick, for example, received £11,517, 17 shillings and one half pence for the first year's rental, and twice that figure during each of the following 2 years. In addition, the Duke received head money of more than £7 for each man, for a total of £42,000 for Brunswick and 6,000 soldiers. For each soldier killed, Brunswick was paid an additional fee, with three wounded counting as one dead. The Prince of Hesse Cassel, Frederick II, earned about $21 million, or 21 million thaler, rather, for his Hessian troops, amounting to a net total of approximately 5 million British pounds. That was almost unheard of sum during his day, and accounted for more than half of the Hesse Cassel fortune inherited by William XI when his father died in 1785. The Hesse Cassel treasury became one of the largest, some say the largest, princely fortunes in Europe because of the American Revolution. The American Revolution followed the pattern of earlier revolutions by weakening the head of state and creating a stronger legislature. Sadly, the American revolutionaries also gave their new nation the same inflatable paper money and central banking systems that had been erected by revolutionaries in Europe. Even before the American Revolution was won, the Continental Congress had gotten into the inflatable paper money business by printing money known as Continental Notes. These notes were declared legal tender by the Congress with nothing to back them. The Continental Congress used the notes to buy the goods it needed to fight the Revolutionary War. Cooperative colonists accepted the money on the promise that the notes would be backed by something after the war was won. As the Continental notes continued to come off Ben Franklin's press, inflation set it. This caused more notes to be printed, which triggered a hyperinflation. After the war was won, a new hard currency, currency backed by metal, was established, and the Continental notes were only redeemable for the new currency. At a rate of 1 cent to the dollar, it was another clear and painful lesson on how paper money, inflation, and devaluation can become tools to help fight nations' wars. Ironically, some American founding fathers used the experience of the Continental notes to urge the creation of a central bank patterned after the Bank of England to better control the currency of the new American nation. I mean, these sons of bitches, it's just like you're doing now. They created a phony money system to fund their war. And when it tanked, propose a new currency so that what they just did with the old currency doesn't happen again. And then they'll just continue it and do it all over again. I mean, my God, they've done this forever, folks. They're doing it again right now as we speak. It's nothing different. I mean, what's their solution to all this stuff? What do we need to do to fix the banks? Well, we need a new bank. That's exactly what they did here. The proposed central bank was a hot issue of debate, with strong emotions running for and against the plan. The pro-bank faction won, of course, after several years of controversy. America's first central bank, the Bank of the United States, was chartered in 1791. The charter expired 20 years later and was renewed after a five-year lapse and was vetoed by President Andrew Jackson in 1836. It regained its charter 27 years later in 1863 and finally became the Federal Reserve Bank, which is America's central bank today, although considerable opposition to a central bank has always existed in the United States. The country has had one under one name or another for most of its history. The founding father credited with creating America's first central bank was Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton joined the revolutionary movement in the early 1700s and rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel and aide-de-camp on Washington's staff by 1777. Hamilton was a good military commander and became a close friend of George Washington and the Marquis de Lafayette. After the war ended, Hamilton studied law, was admitted to the bar, and in February 1784, founded and became director of the Bank of New York. Hamilton's goal was to create an American banking system patterned after the Bank of England. Hamilton also wanted the new U.S. government to assume all state debts and turn them into one large national debt. The national government was to continue increasing its debt by borrowing from Hamilton's proposed central bank, which would be privately owned and operated by a small group of financiers. How was the American government going to repay all of this debt? In an act of supreme irony, Hamilton wanted to place taxes on goods, just as the British had done prior to the Revolution. After Hamilton became Secretary of Treasury, he pushed through such a tax on distilled liquor. This tax resulted in the famous Whiskey Rebellion of 1794, in which a group of mountain people refused to pay the tax and began to speak openly of rebellion against the new American government. At Hamilton's insistence, President George Washington called out the militia and had the rebellion crushed militarily. Hamilton and his backers had managed to establish in the United States a situation identical to England before the American Revolution. A nation deeply in debt, which must resort to taxing its citizens to repay the debt. One might legitimately ask, what did Messrs. Hamilton and Washington, why did they bother participating in the American Revolution at all? They simply used their influence to create the very same institutions in America that the colonists had found so odious under British rule. This question is especially relevant today as the United States faces an astounding national debt and an enormous tax burden on its citizens, far higher than anything ever conceived by the British to impose on the colonists in the 18th century. Although Hamilton's plan, this is exactly why these founding fathers are so bogus and why it's important to point out that they were involved in secret societies and everything else. I mean, my God, they were the ones, yes, they were seen as revolutionaries, But they were paid revolutionaries, just like these paid revolutionaries are being paid to change the government now, and people are buying into it thinking they're real revolutionaries. No. If they're a politician, folks, they're not a part of the real revolution. Okay? Let's go ahead and put that out there right now. The real revolution will never happen at the ballot box. And you can put that on the fucking board. Got me? Although Hamilton's plans were largely successful, they did not go without very considerable opposition, leading the fight against the establishment of a privately owned central bank where James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. They wanted the government to be the issuer of the national currency, not a central bank. In a letter dated December 13, 1803, Jefferson expressed his strong opinion about the Bank of the United States. This institution is one of the most deadly hostility existing against the principles and form of our Constitution. Although one of Jefferson's objections to the central bank rested on his concerns that such a bank might be an obstruction during times of war, he was nonetheless quite far-sighted about some of the effects that such an institution would have. Not only did the U.S. central banks create major financial panics in 1893 and 1907, but the financial fraternity operating the U.S. central bank has exerted and continues to exert even today a strong influence in U.S. affairs, especially foreign affairs, just as Jefferson had warned. It was Jefferson's powerful influence, incidentally, which caused the five-year delay in the renewal of the bank's charter in 1811. We have just finished viewing the American Revolution in a less than rosy light. There was, however, a powerful humanitarian influence at work inside the circle of the founding fathers that must be acknowledged. The United States is one of the freer countries today as a direct result of that influence. Even if Americans are still far from being a completely free people, the American founders affirmed important freedoms, especially those of speech, assembly, of religion, and an excellent constitution was created for the United States as a proven highly workable in such large, diverse society. Ah, suck Satan's cock, Bramley.
Suck Satan's cock.
I don't buy that for a second. It wasn't set up for us. It was set up for them. It was set up. The Constitution was set up for the fucking custodians by the custodians. I mean, why does he do this? I think somebody had an influence on this book or something. It's like he'll sit there and tell you all these things are a fraud, and then he'll backtrack on something like he's, you know, has to put that in there. Oh my God, it was created by these same custodial bastards he's been talking about this whole fucking book. Come on, we know that. The genocide, which seemed to go along with earlier Brotherhood political activity, is conspicuously absent in the American Revolution. American Freemasons today are proud of the role that their brethren played in the American nation, and justly so. The spark of humanitarianism, which periodically resurfaces in the Brotherhood network, surely did so again during the founding of the American Republic. If we were to name a few people of the most important humanitarians among the founding fathers, we might list such well-known figures as Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee. One of the most important of the founding fathers is rarely mentioned, however. He is one in whose memory no large monuments have ever been erected in Washington, D.C. His portrait does not grace any U.S. currency, and he did not even have a postage stamp issued in his honor until 1981. That man was George Mason. George Mason was described by Thomas Jefferson as one of our really great men and of the first order of greatness. Mason is the most neglected of the founding fathers because he ignored political glory, shunned office, and was never famous for his oratory, yet he stands as one of the most far-sighted of the men who created the American nation. After the Revolution, George Mason opposed the plans of Hamilton and declared that Hamilton had done us more injury than Great Britain and all her fleets and armies. It was George Mason who pushed the hardest for the adoption of the Federal Bill of Rights. The 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, which constitute the Bill of Rights, are based upon Mason's earlier Virginia Declaration of Rights, written by him in 1776. The Bill of Rights almost did not make it into the American Constitution, and it would not have done so had not Mason engaged in a heated battle to ensure its inclusion. Despite his chronic ill health, Mason published influential pamphlets denouncing the proposed Constitution because it lacked specified individual rights. Most drafters of the Constitution, including Alexander Hamilton, declared a Bill of Rights unnecessary due to the balance and limitation of powers imposed on the federal government by the Constitution. Mason persisted and was supported by Richard Henry Lee and Thomas Jefferson with the backing of James Madison. The Bill of Rights was finally pushed through to ratification in the final hours. When we consider how the federal government has grown since then and how crucial the Bill of Rights have become, we can appreciate what a man of vision George Mason truly was. His farsightedness and humanitarianism were also manifested in his attempts to completely abolish slavery. At a time when even his friends George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were slave owners, George Mason denounced the slave trade as a disgrace to mankind and worked to have it outlawed throughout all of the states. George Mason did not succeed in his quest during his lifetime, but his dream did come true less than a century later when slavery was abolished in the United States by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. Although most American schoolchildren do not hear much about George Mason in their history lessons or have his portrait hanging in their classrooms, he was one of the greatest heroes of American freedom, human freedom. The renewed spark of humanitarianism, which arose during the American Revolution, was soon overshadowed. The establishment of the inflatable paper money system in the United States was a clue that something was still badly amiss in the Brotherhood network. As similar revolutions led by Freemasons erupted around the world, the old horrors reemerged. One of those horrors was calculated genocide. So that's the end of Chapter 8. The next chapter will begin on next episode. The next episode of the broadcast is Chapter 29, The World of Fire. Yes, so we'll get into that chapter next time. Hey, thanks to everybody for tuning in and being with us here tonight. And, yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. It's almost as if somebody was standing over his shoulder when he was writing this, you know? You expose all this stuff and then you backtrack and say, oh, yeah, but the Constitution's still good, but we're going to tell you why it's bullshit, too. Huh. I don't know. I'm just always suspect of that, you know? It's like, who are you trying to appease and keep happy here, you know? But when these guys own the printing presses that print not only the money, but also the books, you know, you start to see where, okay, you know, sometimes they have to toe the line a little bit, so. I don't know. Anyway, that's it for us tonight, folks. My website's theglobalreality.com. Go there and donate and chip in if you can. And I love you guys. We'll see you next time for the broadcast. Have a great one. Take care.